We're good to roll. So, welcome everyone to the second session on Bernardo Castro's The Idea of the World. It's really nice to have you all here. I want to ask Kyle, did you get a chance to look at the recording of our last session?
I saw a little bit of it. I didn't look at the whole thing.
There's no reason to be a masochist about it. I was just wondering if maybe you saw the introductions part at least, because everybody that's here except you was here last week.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but we could do a real quick run through again.
Let's don't do intros, please. I've already done this 3,000 times. Let's go.
Kyle,
introduce yourself, please.
Yeah. I mean, the intros would be like, I have not introduced myself.
Please, thank you.
So I posted something about my background a little bit. So that's part of an intro. I've never really done anything quite like this. I've done a like an online seminar that was just a one-shot deal, but this is an ongoing thing that seems like a really a cut above your typical forum. So I'm kind of impressed that you guys get together frequently and have these conversations. And so I'm happy to be invited to participate. I'm kind of a loner, really, although I do, most of what I do in groups is like musical stuff, right? So, but philosophy is for me, it has been a very solitary pursuit. I haven't found a lot of people that I can in person discuss things with without their eyes glazing over. I'm still learning how to, have a discussion, you know, that's have an actual verbal discussion about some of these topics. And you may find that I'm actually better in writing. But anyway, I'm a long-term student of various philosophical sources that are, you know, mostly idealist kind of sources. Although, I mean, I'm not a hardcore idealist any more than I'm a hardcore anything else. But you know, when I look back on it, though, yeah, I mean, when I look at the alternatives, then I say, yes, yes, I'm right there. The alternatives to idealism are, to me, extremely unattractive. So it doesn't take much for me to appreciate idealist positions. So I'm really not that good at extemporaneous running my mouth. So I'm going to leave it at that and let people start something.
Well, thanks a lot for that, Kyle. Those of us here who tend to talk a little more do so because we've done it more. We've been around for a while. The cafes have been running for a couple of years, and every once in a while we have a really interesting topic, and I think this is one of them. And the response was exceedingly positive going in. I was really happy that we had such a long thread before the discussion even got started, so to speak. You know, I put up the page for this week's get together, and there was a very avid and thorough response. We got to kick a lot of things back and forth before we even started. And it, I think that's really helpful because it always keeps you thinking about, well, what's the subject at hand and how do I feel about what we're doing? I'm reading Bernardo's book for the second. I read it through once, which is why I was kind of prompted to suggest that we do a session of cafes on it. And I'm now reading it for the second time. And I find it exceedingly helpful to go through that reading with all of the prompts that come from elsewhere. Marco kicked off the discussion. He had a couple of questions that I think we can get into this evening about where some of Bernardo's critique points may or may not be as sound or as cogent as they could be. Other issues get raised along the way. John posted a clip that I found exceedingly helpful about the different kinds of isms, because there's all these isms running around. That was very helpful for me in sorting things out. Like you, I'm not a professional philosopher at all. I've taken a couple of courses here and there, I guess most people have at one time or another, but nothing in a very focused or coherent way. So I think we're all a little bit armchairish, if I could say it that way, in our philosophical dealings with the world. But we're all individuals who are very interested in these kinds of things, I was pretty sure, and it's being reinforced and confirmed through this, that we have a group of people who are interested in these kinds of things and would like to take a closer look. So I think that's exactly what we should be able to do. In this part of the book, Bernardo kind of lays out his case for why he thinks the current, or I'll just call it the dominant paradigm, is not as effective as it should be, and we should look for an alternative. He says that right in the preamble of these chapters, that it's worth looking for alternatives. Let's put it that way. He thinks that the status quo has some shortcomings that we need to overcome. And to me, it's not just a matter of who's right here. That was one of the nice things about the clip that John posted. It kind of keeps this whole discussion open. There could be various ways of looking at the topic, so to speak. Nevertheless, we all tend in some way or another towards something. We all have our feeling. I don't know how it is with you guys, but when I'm reading, there's some things where I think, oh yeah, I was thinking something like that. And then later I'm reading something and I'm going, I've never thought anything like that before. You know, so I kind of alternate between those different states. But at the same time, I'm looking for, you know, what case is he making? How sound is that case? What's the upsides to it? Where's the advantages to it? And where is he coming up a little short? Or where could he perhaps have made a stronger argument for what he's arguing about? So we're in one of those realms, I think, where it's really hard to quote-unquote prove whatever it is that we're trying to say, because there's a limit to how far we can go with our minds. So in this section, this being the what he thinks is wrong with physicalism, let us say, that's the basis for the discussion, but that's not anywhere that we actually have to remain. So what I'd like to do right now is simply open the floor for comments, questions, or critiques that we can then use as a springboard for our further discussion. So this is your chance to jump in there and get it off your chest, or or break a lance, or whatever it is that you feel that you have to do right now. So I'll shut up and let you guys at this.
I'm ready to jump. Okay, so my style of reading anybody is totally influenced by the job I had before I even fell in love with reading, and that was maintenance. So I kind of gravitate to any metaphor that has to some kind of dexterity, use, how he was... I was sensitive to the way he was building his argument, if that's the way I can put it. And certain phrases, which I would consider building blocks for me to understand, was like, in the sense of being structurally equivalent, despite being irreversibly arranged. I'm just going to throw some bricks on the table, pardon me. codependent opposites. One of the special to me was the special thing he was bringing in is conscious perception is fundamentally unreliable? Well, notice that it is also conscious perception that eventually dispels the illusion. That really hit me hard because when you're a maintenance person, you are constantly working with, oh, I thought this would work and it wouldn't. So there's a sense of an illusion going on, but you have to get back into your or trust your perception. You can even change that or notice that. So that hit me right square behind, you know, in the eyes. And then I really like how he's really bringing some very focused intention to just paying attention to these models or whatever you want to call them that have got us into trouble, that literally the models themselves being unquestioned, unexamined, is what I think he's trying to bring attention to. Knowing that it's really important that we pay attention to that. That's all I have to say at this point. Thank you for listening.
We always listen, Michael, like I said before.
I might like to put the work of Bernardo Kastrup a little bit in context, because I think we should also look at this, at him, and not only at him, but there are also others nowadays who are going this, I don't know how to call it, anti-physicalist philosophy. I don't know what correct term to use, but an alternative view to the strict materialistic and physicalist rationalist science. And I remember that about 25 years ago, so more or less, I don't know really exactly, I was quite deep in this philosophy of mind issues. I was involved, not directly, but I was very interested in it. And I remember that I wrote also an entire book that I am now trying to get out and to rewrite in a more modern version. And where all these things that are now coming up almost didn't exist. If you look at most philosophers of mind, there were exceptions, of course. Chalmers, not really. David Chalmers, I would not say that he's really an anti-physicalist, but in any case, there were only few, but almost all philosophers of mind were strict and die-hard materialists. And the phenomenon that we are seeing now today, I think is very distinctive of our times. there is a sort of renaissance, a sort of rethinking some dogmas that have dominated, I would not say so much science in any case, but also the philosophy of mind, the people who studied the consciousness and so on. For example, now we see there are several panpsychists. One might agree or disagree with the panpsychic movement, but this was almost anathema in 25 years ago. Even if the idea, the panpsychist idea is old as, I don't know, you can trace it back to the ancient Greece perhaps, yeah? But it was some sort of no-go. Nowadays you see there are many people. Also another sort of movement to which I don't know if I would put also in there Bernardo Castro, but there's a sort of cosmopsychism movement. That is, people who don't think that consciousness is proper to any single particle, but of the universe as a whole, and the universe is in this consciousness. It's not only that consciousness, but it's an expression of that consciousness. And Castro distances himself from this movement, but you can say that he's much more a cosmopsychist than a panpsychist. And there are also other people who are working on this idea. And also the idea to take into account Eastern philosophies nowadays is much more accepted than it was 25 years ago. So for a long time, I was a bit annoyed because it was in the Western philosophers, at least, you could find almost no one going this way. So I myself forgot about it almost completely and got busy with a lot of other things. And now I take these things up again, and I hope also to come to some hopefully interesting writing, because I think we are now seeing that things are changing in this regard. There are a lot of ideas, sometimes also very contrasting, but they're not all strictly adherent to this physicalist approach. They are opening to other ideas. And this, I think, this is a real distinctive aspect that characterizes people like Kastrup, whatever they might say, or maybe they are also wrong, you might not disagree, but this is, historically speaking, looking at the phenomenon as a whole, historically, this is, I think, what is happening. And I'm very happy with that.
Well, I can take the opportunity also what Marco said about this momentum that we are assisting. I like to think that it's not my bias observation, that there is something going on. And you mentioned the panpsychism that has been getting more exposed, or there are more adherents. And also I have been seeing popping up the work of Aldous Huxley, also like the and his perennial philosophy, and also the book of Doors of Perception, that and I think that also can be linked to this. I'm not, maybe if we would look at the charts of the book sales, that if there would be some correlation that nowadays. Regarding the book and the chapter, the two, yes, I think it's the concept of explanatory abstraction that really I think it's very fruitful for me, because it also explains how there has been this overly abstractic, that I don't know the fancy words they use, that rational, like logic constructs that really don't correspond to our direct experience. So excuse me the term, but this is a very vulgar term, but I'm going to use like mental masturbation. So there has been this kind that have been trying to explain. And in that sense, it's very fresh that Kastrup brings this ideas, arguments that make sense intuitively or in terms of experience. And I don't even need to feel like bad about it in that side of thing. So yeah, I think that's healthy. I mean, I read the chapter 1 and 2. I didn't read the chapter 3. Thanks.
So I will go now. I just following on both Marco and Daniel. I also agree on this kind of context, okay, that the new context, let's put it this way, where now all these new, you know, worldviews, idealist, panpsychism, and cosmos psychism, et cetera, are kind of being more exposed, et cetera. I think it's, I really also appreciate that. At the same time, I am starting to discover, because when I really got in contact first time, it was a very light kind of read and very light understanding, like Carl Jung and other philosophers also. Now you see them also when you start reading them with a different perspective as well. I wonder why, right? So for me, the question is why the context is changing? Why now suddenly idealism is back? Okay, because I agree also that, starting with Plato, basically. Starting with Plato, Platonic idealism, already this is very old, but it went away sometime, and especially with the scientific revolution. I mean, it was completely, displaced and replaced by physicalism and materialism. But I wonder why now this is happening. Okay, so what is that? I'm interested in your thoughts on that. Why this is happening? One thing that I feel really quite close to Bernardo Kastrup, metaphysics. Okay, so as I am reading it and getting more familiarized. Still, what I'm discovering the more and more I read and watch conversations and all that is that the struggle with the language, that many times there are lots of discussions that I see that are non-discussions, if you want, in the sense that all those discussions are born out of ambiguity with the language. And this annoys me a bit. Because I feel that it would be much more productive if we get first on the same page about what we mean by certain things and by certain terms. I know that is difficult when you do philosophy, but I feel that many discussions, and especially even in those public discussions where Bernardo writes an essay and then gets a response, et cetera, you can see that they are not talking the same language. They are attacking straw mans. So it's a bit, I'm not really enjoying that much. Okay. So, and with Bernardo, and I've been following you a bit, Marco, because I saw that you are bringing quite consistently certain, these kind of issues, about what do you mean by mind? What do you mean by this and that concept, et cetera, et cetera, and consciousness, and about the conflation of these terms, et cetera. And to me, this is very important that it's clarified. And sometimes I don't feel that Bernardo really puts enough effort in clarifying. Perhaps for him, it's very easy and very clear. But frankly, I mean, if you want really to make your point and bring people with you, etc. I think you have to be careful that that people really understand that I am struggling. I mean, I struggle much more with other, you know, contemporary philosopher, let's put it this way. So I think Bernardo is quite, in that sense, I would say I would appreciate his clarity, but still I miss, there is an opportunity from my point of view for improvement in this area. And what for me was really eye-opening, and thank you, John, for the video clip that you posted, because that changed also the way that I am looking at this now, right? So even I have a lot of sympathy for Kastrup's metaphysics, I can also appreciate the multiple, you know, worldviews that there have been over the history, and also perhaps in different contexts. And then you wonder really whether there is a true worldview, or are all those kind of images from different angles of what really is the truth. No, it's like those orbiting perspectives. But and then I asked the question also, I am fine with that. And I really, for me, that was also, thank you for that discovery. But I wonder whether there are some views that are eventually closer to the truth than others, okay? And whether we can really fine-tune, okay, our worldview. But I like very much that perspective. And I definitely, one of my pending reads, it's going to be this book, okay, just to understand better the details. So that's what I basically got from so far from the discussion and reading those two chapters. So that's for now what I want to share with you, basically.
I guess it's my turn. I didn't read this. I read the intro to this essay, and I just noticed he says, it is my contention that some of the key problems of ontology that contemporary philosophers have been grappling with do not exist. So that seemed to me to let me off the hook, because if it doesn't exist, I don't see why I have to read this essay. I've read so many essays by Kastrup and by all of his opponents, and many of his opponents. And I've been reading, as many of you have, maybe 30 years in theory of mind, you know, with Dawkins and the Churchlands, and I find there's been no progress in this field at all. They're saying the same thing over and over and over and over. There will be critics who come in and say, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And they seem to have total amnesia for what has been said previously, because they have nothing, they have no good arguments. And this is becoming so obvious that I can't remember the philosopher, Nagel. He wrote a book on, I think, cosmos and mind. And he sort of comes out of he's very friendly to materialism, and he is an academic. But he was just blowing the whistle and saying, listen up, this does not make sense. And someone like Steven Pinker, of course, got in a real tizzy over this. And they had a real, basically branded him as a traitor. And I was thinking, where is that kind of fury coming from? It seems to me it's certainly not science. It's much more maybe scientism. It looks a lot more like religion than it does anything like science. As we all know, many very great scientific thinkers were not necessarily materialists. They could think out, they could use that, and then they could exit it and do something else. And there are many people, and I think I'm referencing some of Kastrup's, he likes this book. I found out about it because of him, Beyond Physicalism. It's a companion piece to another book he recommends called Irreducible Mind. And these are scientists and social thinkers, and they all have PhDs, and they all have gotten together and basically debunked the current dominant materialist paradigm with very, very good arguments. But the best arguments I can come up with are my own personal experience. It just does not make any sense if I adopt this very narrow materialism. There may be other materialisms out there that I'm pretty open to exploring. I just got a book on feminist materialisms, and another book called New Materialisms. So we have a speculative realism. We have many different kinds of materialism. And I'm sure there will be new kinds of idealisms coming out of all of this, because as we know, these different isms need one another. But I do think, as we are, some of us are Gebser scholars, I think Bernardo is focusing his attention in the very narrow external materialist focus of those who are in the dominant positions, maybe in academia. And I think he's looking at, I think, deficient forms of the mental. I think this is what Gibson would call this discussion that was had with the atheist materialism and Bernardo. I think someone posted that. I don't know who did, but I enjoyed it. Did you do that? Is that you, Jaime?
No, I don't think that was me, but I know which one you say.
Yeah, I think
it was me.
That was Mark.
I was. It was video with Tom. I don't remember now.
Yes, I watched that.
But you could tell that everything Bernardo said, it went through one ear and out the other.
Yeah.
He heard nothing. So I think this kind of mindset, when it gets hardened, the hardening of the categories, I appreciate we may have criticisms of Bernardo Kastrup. I also think we should need to appreciate his audience and who he's trying to address and who is in opposition to him. And I don't think they are representative of all of humanity, actually. I think it's a very small group of academics who, usually have tenure, and they're hunkering down. But they are, I think, contaminating other kinds of initiatives and efforts that could be happening, that are not happening. So a handful of these academics, we are all in the undertow of their arrested development. That's my view. And if we look at remote viewing, which the CIA sponsored back in the 90s, highly successful psychics were being used to spy. And they were more successful than the satellites that they were using. That's why they funded it. Near-death experience, there's been an explosion of interest in this. Lucid dreaming, which I've had hundreds of. Out-of-body experiences, I've probably had about 100 of those. Telepathy, precognition. On and on and on. Many, many, many persons have had these experiences. The only way they can articulate clearly their experience and share it with others, which is hard enough when these non-ordinary experiences happen, but it's made very difficult when the medical establishment and the academics and this materialist paradigm will censor you, and sometimes in very, very harsh ways. So I think there's a kind of self-protection that is very understandable. So we just don't go that way. And we hang out with people that we have some affinity for or some affiliation with, whom we can share our experiences with. And rather than, turn everything into a debating society with Patricia Churchland and Dawkins. And I think they're hardening of their categories. Anyway, so I'm just sharing that, letting you guys know where I'm coming from. and how I have a great sympathy for Bernardo. And also, we need to pay attention that there are more than there are many audiences right now. I recently went to the Helix Center to hear a discussion with some mathematicians. I don't know if I told you guys this. I told this to another group. And one of the authors in this, I think his name is Harold Anspacher. He wrote an essay in here. And I read one of his books. He's a physicist. And so I went to the Helix Center to hear a conversation with him. And Graham Harman was there. I don't know if you know the philosopher, leading philosopher in speculative realism. He was there. He was in the audience sitting right next to me. And there were half a dozen other very bright people on the panel and out in the audience. And after listening to these mathematicians go on and on and on, and the conversation was, it was called Mathematics and Other Realities. So they invited the audience afterwards to go up to the microphone and talk. Ask a question, pose a question, whatever. So I did, with some trepidation. I felt there were some friendly persons out there who are definitely beyond materialism, but the center of gravity was definitely a physicalist among these physicists, even though they admitted there were a great deal of conflicts. And I just asked them, well, first of all, I said, initially, the beginning of last century, there was the fourth dimension entered into the imagination of the public. Then when I was in the 60s, when I was a boy, we watched television. And I remember watching Rod Serling on the Twilight Zone. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Remember that? And he talked about the fifth dimension. And now we're in the internet age. And in the introduction, the woman who introduced this panel and the audience, she mentioned we have three audiences here. The audience in the room, the audience beyond the room, because it's live streaming, and the audience of the future who will be watching in the archive. And I added to that, I said, and all of us in this room can be a member of that future audience. Because when this is uploaded, we can be members of that audience. So with all of that, I want to know, what do you know now that you did not know before you started this conversation? And what difference does knowing that make? Which was very funny because I got silence at first, which was not my intention, but I also I noticed around the room, a lot of people are doing this. I said, okay, that's a nonverbal communique to me that something is registering because I am not a mathematician. And I think we're in real trouble when the experts and the non-experts cannot sit in the same room and find a common discourse. So that's been my intention in showing up today and showing up in many of these forums, either online or offline. And hopefully that, you know, each of us, I'm sure, are engaged in something very similar. We're trying to make sense of our worlds and we need other people to do that. But which other people? Because everyone is going to be on your same wavelength. And finally, in closing, this is to share a little bit of frustration. I went to a play on Sunday, a small play, and I got in the theater, about 100 seats. So it's a very small theater, very small stage. We're talking about off Broadway. And, you know, they asked us to turn off our devices and please, you know, don't rattle paper. If you have a cold or something and you need to take a lozenge, do that before you, because this is a small theater and the actors can get easily distracted. I thought it was sad that she had to ask for that kind of permission, but you know, so the curtain rises, the actors come out on stage, and the guy next to me falls asleep. He's asleep for the first half hour. When he wakes up, he pulls out his smartphone and he's scrolling through his messages. while the hardworking actors are up there trying to establish rapport. And I immediately felt the energy in the entire theater started to, there was so much static that the performers could barely make it through to creating a shared reality, a shared imaginal reality, because of this nitwit with his fucking smartphone, who could barely stay awake because his mind is so shattered by the technology. So I'm just adding that as just, that's evidence as far as I'm concerned, that we're in real trouble, or at least the theater arts are in real trouble. There are really, really good reasons to stay home. And I wish this guy had, because it ruined my concentration. Anyway, I'm just sharing this with you guys, and I don't know what's going to happen next, but I think this is very important what we're doing, sharing attention and studying some very complex ideas and trying to make sense of a very increasingly complex and I think very cluttered world we're living in. So thank you.
I just wanted to tie in with what I'm listening to the article I posted about the blind spot in science that I thought was a really good sense of what everybody kind of is bringing, talking about, and Bernardo too, in a way, of science or scientism or science materialism has a blind spot that's not necessarily what science is really about, you know? And also part of what I feel science, and even I will say religion and certain spiritual traditions and the way they describe how to do any kind of inquiry or research about your own experience, leaving out our direct experience, you know, was part of blind spot, is to get caught in this tension between the first person and the third person. I want to work with both. I don't, John and I sometimes have promoted that kind of, it's not about, I drop the contention between the third person and the first person. And I think by dropping the contention, we get what we have on this site, the interpersonal, that's willing to add that other dimension that we need to start having better conversations, like John says, and I totally agree, of the layperson and the expert. This is what I run into when I'm very philosophical in the sense that I want to engage people about ideas, about things. But like somebody else kind of pointed out, I forget who, it was Kyle. You know, within the first minute when you open your mouth and start doing, there's this glaze that goes over. They don't want to encounter that kind of openness. I call it openness because of the technology and consumer society doesn't, it grabs your attention and you're addicted to it. Seems to me.
Yeah, that kind of triggered me in a good way, because I see the same thing going on with people of our generation, you know, so we'll talk about boomers. I think we can see that the people who have come after us, the millennials especially, are kind of victims of mass hypnosis that on a scale that we were not as we were coming up. Right. So I am interested in that question of, you know, the bigger picture of how things are changing over time. I think that the increased interest in idealism in its various forms might have something to do with the fact that, you know, there are two things going on. There's an increase in that kind of interest in idealism. While there is a declining church membership, right? So I don't know if these two things have to do with each other, but all I know is that people who have questions that are not addressed by physicalist, you know, by just the kind of default flatlander mentality that, you know, it's kind of the default. This is, if you don't have enough energy or whatever to get beyond that, then that's where you are pretty much, you know. And I don't know exactly what can be done about that, but I think this is obviously a group of people who are interested in doing something about that kind of issue.
I just want to, Kyle, distance myself a little bit from your remarks, although I appreciate very much where you're coming from, because I know a lot of millennials. Some of my best friends are millennials, and they're up against things that we, as you mentioned, we were not up against, the boomers. So I think that we had TV, that was bad enough. I think, streaming internet 24/7 is taking that to a different level. And I found for some millennials, they're brilliant people and they can make sense of it, and some cannot, just as some of us boomers can't make sense of it either. So I wanted to bring in Douglas. Are you available to talk? I think you're closer to the millennials than anyone here, age-wise. But I think psychologically and emotionally, I am much more attracted to the millennial orientations very often than I am to persons my own age group. So I don't think we have to identify with any age group, especially around, so many of them are rallying around Bernie. And I think Bernie Sanders just won the Nevada caucus this weekend. And I feel like there's a surge happening right now, which I welcome. And most of that is driven by the collectivization of the millennial sort of, I think, something new that's coming online and in our social worlds that we really do need to pay attention to and to nurture as best as we can. So thanks.
The key word I'm picking up on right now, is everyone able to hear me? It is engagement. That's something we can all do more of, whether we are loners or already engaged in some sort of activity or live in a bustling city. Here in Kentucky, there's not much to engage. So here I am online. I'm not a millennial, nor do I engage with millennials, but I engage with my elders here. And I learn quite a bit. And what I appreciate about what we do here, what I appreciate about Bernardo Kastrup and his work, is the level of engagement that we and he puts into ideas. And I'll trickle this into Kastrup's work, that just the level of engagement that he allows it, like Kyle just said, it takes a certain amount of energy, and it's so easy to shut off from a conversation with someone just simply because of anxiety issues, the difficulty of, like, we've had 30 to 60 to 70 years of separate reality, supposedly, and to engage in a conversation, we have to consider what we just ate, let alone our philosophical mindset, if it ever reaches that point. And what I like about Bernardo is how he engages, and he's willing to engage with anyone. Those who I thought he had equal worldviews with the multiple, the Steiner video that was posted with Matt Siegel and Robert McDermott. I don't know if those are the correct names, but they have a certain worldview. And I thought the panpsychist realist worldview that they, Matt Siegel holds, it was compatible with this version of Bernardo's idealism. And then I found some archive of him and Matt going at each other's philosophy, trying to nitpick and get to the point of what exactly is the difference and why Bernardo is not a panpsychist, but maybe perhaps he is. And so he's willing to engage, and all turns aside, at the end of the day, that engagement is really what makes a difference in my mind. And it's perhaps the most efficient way to learn. I don't want to say the best, or maybe efficient isn't the right word, but to actually engage with someone. None of us are here together in the same room, but seeing each other's faces, and I don't see anybody piddling on their phone or anything like that. We are engaged in this conversation, as difficult as it might be. So with Kastrup's work, that's really the core that I appreciate with it. He's fully engaged in what it might be to a fault at times, to where he's on a mission to overturn an entire worldview that's been going on for a couple hundred years, but he seems like he's on the right track, and he might make mistakes along the way, and he might have a personality that prevents him from admitting to these mistakes. So it's good that he has all of these voices coming from all sides engaging with this. So
I want to, along that theme of engagement, is I have a millennial daughter who is connected to Bernie Sanders, and she was very, her first political engagement was with Bernie Sanders back in 2016. And having been raised in back in similar times, I feel there's similar tones happening now that happened in the 60s and 70s. It's a similar tone, reoccurring tone of newness, of vibrato, of you know, back then it was Marshall McLuhan was trying to bring forward how technology could shape us, and now we're seeing really raw, intensified examples of that. And this issue of engagement to me with my daughter was not to cut her enthusiasm, but to engage from a less authoritarian approach that part of my growing through the 60s was about, is I don't want to get caught in reacting to authoritarianism. I want to respect it, but challenge it, if anybody can understand that nuance. And it was a perfect example with my daughter to practice that, to engage that, of honoring her enthusiasm for Bruno, for Bernie, his idealism. What I brought to the table to her was great idealism, but there's a practice of how to make real those ideas, how to enact them, especially in the political arena. But to me, it was a personal arena of giving my daughter a voice, but at the same time, you're not going to get off easy of just going down the road of getting sucked into idealism, because you need to critique what idealism you're enacting, to me. And that's what I really appreciate about Bernardo, his critique. And like Doug is saying, he's helped me learn his language and what he's bringing forward, whether I agree or not. The sense I gravitate to is honing my skill to engage and with whoever. And I believe me, people on this site know, I practice this on a day-to-day level. I had a similar situation like this just 4 hours ago with a friend of mine over the word non-binary. He couldn't, and he's a gay guy. He couldn't why do we need that word? I said, because my daughter feels that that's the way she wants to describe herself. So anyway, just some notes from the field kind of thing. Thank you.
I'm just wondering if here again we are conflating things, because the word idealism, I'm not sure that I did understand, Michael, your point, but the word idealism that you might mean, the idealism of your daughter, is, I think, something completely different from the philosophical idealism we are talking about here, which is fine. It's very relevant what you're saying. Yeah? Because the point, if a philosophical theory, what does it give us from the practical point of view in everyday life? This is a very relevant point, of course. But just as a side note, I'm not sure that everyone here means the same thing with the word idealism. And I myself, when I never say that I'm an idealist, because there are different sorts of idealism also in the philosophical context. For example, here again, we have the problem with Kastrup that he says, I don't remember the exact words, but he says that idealism is a theory which means that everything is mentation. Yes, that's correct, I think, but it is only one sort of idealism. There are different sorts of idealism. So I don't want to lose myself in words and definitions. I'm not saying that we should define things. It's important, especially these things which have an experiential inner dimension, cannot be defined. Because words, the definitions rely on words, and these words rely again on phenomenal content, on experiences. So you cannot define the experience with experience itself. It becomes circular, something recursive. But, well, okay, here perhaps that's my fixating point, that we should be careful with words, because otherwise we use the same word and everyone means something else. But at any rate, I wanted also to take up shortly another point that raised, I think it was Jamie, who asked why now idealism. Yes, it's a question. I don't have the pretension to have just a wonderful answer that explains everything. Not, absolutely not. But I think, okay, I just express an opinion on this. Let's put it in this way. Again, I think if we frame these questions and look at it only from a purely intellectual point of view and materialistic point of view, physicalist point of view, scientific point of view, I don't think you will never find a real answer to these questions. But I think if we, again, take a little bit, how can I, spiritualist point of view? I don't know if these words, here again, everyone might think it's something else. And so, not necessarily a mystic approach, but not exclusively scientific and intellectual approach. And if we look at the spiritual development and evolution of mankind, I think we can see why idealism, or I would say non-physicalism, non-physicalist approaches, are becoming now more trendy. And I think if we look again at the broad picture, how science was born 4 centuries ago, and there was a renaissance, and especially the Age of Enlightenment, which wanted to drag down and put everything, look at the world and to ourselves only from the scientific and purely materialistic point of view, that it was a necessary transition. I wrote an essay on this, which I entitled Physicalism and Reason Are Transitional. That is, physicalism and reason have been necessary and to some degree are still necessary for humankind to develop its reason, its intellect, its mind. But it is not the last rung of the ladder of evolution. And I think we are now in this transitional period where this, what gave us a lot of force to proceed in this evolution, that is science, reason, the intellect, the mind, the strictly materialistic point of view, they had a reason to be, and they have they gave us a lot. But now we must realize that they are only a transitional. They were only a transitional period in the human history and in the development of the intellect of the human mind. And we must now slowly look beyond. What there is beyond, well, okay, nobody knows. But the future cannot be only science and reason alone. I think science and reason will continue to have its place. But we should look at this from the evolutionary perspective. And I think this is why now idealism is coming through, because the collective consciousness is slowly awakening to the fact that science and reason could give us a lot of things, but has its limits, and these limits are becoming more and more apparent.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah. Okay.
It seems that was the same thing that was happening in the 60s and 70s, an idealism. Is there a difference between that idealism, trying to stay with whatever way you define it, and now? Is there any kind of transitional thread that unites the two? Possibly.
Yeah. Again, I think I'm speaking of the philosophical idealism. You are probably speaking more of the idealism in ideas, political idealism.
No, I'm not sure. You may be right, but it's still philosophical to me. I don't need to specialize the philosophical science or whatever. It's just philosophy to me, in the sense that of trying to understand how do we enact and live our lives.
Yes, I agree on this. As I said, there's this practical, the connection between the theoretical and the practical. This is correct. But I think there is a difference between what Kastrup is speaking now and the idealism of the 60s, which might be also now.
Okay. I just, because of growing up with a similar tone, and agreeing there, I'm connecting a feeling, a similar tone that's happening now. And I don't know what the difference is.
Can I interject something? Thank you very much, both of you, for bringing up certain things that are very confusing. But you're talking about the tone of the 60s and the tone of your daughter as she's working with Bernie. And this movement that he's creating, and your daughter was participating in, and you're taking a realist stance with her, a non-authoritarian, open to the idealism. That's a use of idealism, and I'm fine with that. And I also understand, Marco, when you talk about you're worried about we're conflating different things, and the a strict use of idealism like German idealism. We're talking about Kant, we're talking about Hegel and the transcendental ego. And there were a lot of differences among the idealists. And also spiritualism, or what Robert McDermott was talking about in that conversation with Matt Siegel, whether it's spiritualism or spiritism, they don't mean the same thing. And that's not necessarily the same thing as idealism. So I think we have a long history with these isms, and there's no reason to think that they're all that they're not evolving through our use. But I just want to add something about the tone of the 60s and the tone of what's happening now, and idealism as a synonym almost for vision. And I believe why I'm talking about politics here, because I think there's a deep relationship between idealism, materialism, spiritism, economics, science, and ecology. I mean, I believe there is a form of vision that some politicians have it and some politicians don't. But if you want to mobilize people and you want to create a movement, a vision may be a prerequisite. And I'm going to quote, I think there's a relationship between vision and idealism in the way that you were talking about when you were talking about tone. Because I think vision operates as a holding term for multiple functions. As a physical sense, a set of practices and discourses and metaphors that translates between different mediums. Vision is a discourse that multiplies and divides from within. Vision cannot be taken as an isolated form of perception, but rather must be understood as inseparable from the other senses. And this is a quote, I can't remember the author, I apologize, but I think this is a form of vision that's very similar to a lot of idealism, which is driven not necessarily by having all the facts or the factoids, because we're living in a world of post-truth now. So we have a lot of factoids, which is sort of like facts and drag. People are making it up. But I think this is very important to contrast and compare to what is meant by idealism in the more rigid sort of philosophical, historical sense. And that made me morphing too. And I think that they all may be exaggerated. And materialism as well is transforming. There are a lot of, there's this new materialism that's coming online, and a lot of people are trying to figure out what in the hell matter is. No one seems to have a clue. So you want to talk about spiritualism as airy-fairy and ephemeral? What could be more ephemeral than physics and subatomic particles and their very slippery behavior? So anyway, that's my spiel. I hope this, but I think everyone's bringing to the table their own, sort of visceral understandings. And I think we should honor and respect first-person accounts and those micro-narratives, like I shared earlier, the guy falling asleep next to me in the theater, waking up and skimming through his smartphone text messages. I think these kind of small micro-narratives are relevant and we should be bringing them forward. But we should also recognize there are third-person accounts that we need to coordinate. And I think we have a unique opportunity to do so. And we're also in uniquely perilous times that we probably need to really focus our eyes on the prize here, because it's easy to get distracted. So thanks.
Thank you, John and Marco, both for engaging what I had to say. Thank you.
And I had a kind of a follow-up question, right, after this. Why? Because I feel that we are having this discussion around idealism and also recognizing that there is a kind of a renaissance of idealism. But it feels to me that it's a kind of a discussion in a very niche kind of circle of people, academics, and then independent scholars and aficionados, et cetera, which is really niche, if you are going to compute that. And in particular, when we talk about metaphysics, so idealism as a metaphysic. And I wonder whether there is a kind of a parallelism with the mainstream, And the reason that I am bringing this is because I just read an article about that I follow because I find very interesting as extreme materialism and really scientific fanatism, if you want, from Peter Diamandis and the Singularity kind of colleagues. I don't know if you are familiar with the Singularity University. But basically, today I read an article, I think, I'm not fully sure if it was BBC or somewhere else, where they were claiming that we are very close to the velocity escape of longevity. Basically, very close to achieve, let's say, the situation where science will help you live beyond, so every year, a bit more than a year. So we have achieved this velocity, escape velocity, so you virtually could live forever, okay, physically. And then they, let's say, lay out a series of research and very promising, scientific discoveries and advances, like fights against certain very aggressive cancers, but also the possibility to remove or erase from the DNA lots of already genetic diseases, more than I can remember how many thousands of diseases that are of genetic genetic nature, so that you could edit those genes and then remove them. So those diseases don't exist anymore, basically. It's not that you treat the disease, it's that you basically remove them, right? And a few more things, right? And I feel that this is, for mainstream people, really exciting and very good news, and is what really people have the appetite for, right? So to have this kind of news of scientific progress and really, this also, okay, eventually having this imagination that I could live forever, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. So I feel that there is perhaps a disconnect, but maybe this is an impression that I have. Also, Kyle, you mentioned the church kind of a registration and attendance rate going down. I'm not fully sure we necessarily need to correlate that with idealism, being trendy again in this niche kind of a group of people. But I feel that perhaps there is a disconnect. And as in the first conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago, for me, it's as important, talk and discuss and understand a bit the metaphysics and have an ontology that resonates, with me. But it's also even more important what the implications in our lives and how we live in a community, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, that's even more important. The reason that I go to the root, it's because I believe from the root you have certain implications, okay? So idealism and materialism, for example, I think lead you to live your life in very different ways, right? Or even healthcare, for example, right? So if you posit materialism, basically you remove already any more holistic kind of healthcare treatment that also includes psychological treatment and a more holistic approach to medicine. While with the idealism, you embrace that already as a starting point, right? So I believe there is genuine implications from, whatever ontology you pick or metaphysics that you pick. But I'm really more interested in that. And I'm not fully sure. I feel that the world is becoming more and more increasingly materialist, whilst perhaps there is this niche of philosophers and academics that eventually are starting to consider idealism. But maybe, I don't know, what is your perception, guys? And yeah, that's the reason that I like very much Karstrup's efforts also to try to make this, his views understandable also, by more mainstream people. Still, it's quite advanced, I would say. but at least it's it tries to get closer to mainstream, and I appreciate that. But and also I appreciate his efforts in covering those topics that are more of practical purposes, like for example when he discusses approach to medicine, or even for example more spiritual kind of life, etc. I find this really the most interesting and for me, interesting, and that I like more than just going into the pure theory of category mistakes and all these that he speaks, okay, over and over. I just wanted to share that with you because I have that impression, but maybe not, that there is a kind of a awareness also or a change in the awareness, and people embracing more kind of idealism based ways of living, right? And ethics and right. And even political stance, if you want.
I have a response to that I'd love to share, but if someone else wants to go for it,
Let me just interject one.
Please,
one
Kyle, thing. Go for it.
Just because you the part about, you know, so Bernardo does a good job of breaking down all these variations of idealism, right? And variations of you know, philosophical schools. I'm surprised that he doesn't have more of an effort to sort of consolidate, you know, and say, okay, whose team are we on, guys? All you panpsychists, all you cosmopsychists, all you old school idealists, new school idealists and everything. We have something in common, right? And we're outnumbered. And so instead of arguing with each other about what is precisely the correct idealism, there's some way to draw these threads together and form some more substantial resistance. We are the resistance, right? That's all.
I hear you, and I'm also poignantly aware when I hear that they're on the verge of a breakthrough. I'm responding to something that you said, Jaime, and I've heard this too, that we will live forever. Which of us will be granted this privilege? All of us? Also, where, when you live forever, will you live? And what will you live upon? I'm bringing this up because very recently we've lost 3 billion birds in North America, have vanished. One-fifth of the coral reef has died in the last 3 years. We hear that there's 70, it was recorded 70 degrees in Antarctica. If the ice cap melts, of course, that will change the atmosphere so that we will not be protected from radiation from the sun. So I'm just raising these questions, which I think are have to be coordinated with this fantasy, I would say, of living forever. Go for it, but let's also, well, maybe how much money is this going to be, how much of the gross national product is going to go into this project? And who is that going to be benefiting? I think those become very politically charged questions, especially as many people are questioning whether science can be disentangled from the war machine and the AI that is predicted to, you know, surpass human intelligence in the next decade or so. So I'm just bringing all that to the table too, and wondering if there's a relationship between the facts and the factoids and what's imagination and what's real? Because it seems to me, whether you call yourself a scientist or you call yourself a poet, you're drawing upon the imagination. And I think the metaphors that we use can tell us a lot about where we're coming from. And I really appreciate, Marco, that you mentioned the interesting use of metaphor that Kastrup employed when he was debating with this atheist materialist. So I think those creative uses of metaphor actually, to a little bit extent, perturb these materialist atheists. And that is a good thing, I think, because I think it makes them sort of have to, it's like a speed bump, you know, something bumps, you know, and it rattles them a little bit, but then they go right back into the old groove, but at least they had that experience of a speed bump. And I think that's what metaphors are good for. That's a very healthy use of metaphor. So thanks.
Yeah, I think, okay, I might connect this speech that Kastrup had with Tom Jump on this video. I think it was quite illuminating because it makes it clear what kind of rational, of what kind of thinking stands behind materialism. And actually, I mean, those who probably follow me on the forum, like Jaime, see that I engage with some people, but not because I want to convince them, but because what I like, I want to get in their mindset and try to understand what is it that they are not getting, because I don't get it what they don't get. So sometimes I insist almost stubbornly in a confrontation, not because I would like confrontations, quite the contrary, but I want to know where is the problem in communication between the materialist, physicalist, and call it the idealist. I prefer spiritualist, but okay, also this word may mean a lot of things. And here perhaps not a disagreement with you, Jaime, but I see these things perhaps a little bit from another perspective, where you say that the world is becoming increasingly materialist. Yes, if you look at the facts, how science, for example, medical science is becoming even more reductionist, even more physicalist, even more. Everything nowadays is neuronal, genetic, molecular, and beyond that, there is nothing. No? Yes, this trend is apparently hardening, but I look at it from the optimist point of view, and I believe that it is a reaction to something that they feel is crumbling. When your empire is crumbling, you will become, especially then, in that moment, you will become especially aggressive in trying to reimpose your empire, so to speak. And I think this increasing materialism is a reaction to something that they more or less consciously, unconsciously feel is coming. And look at it also, if you look at the internet, there's a lot of confusion, of course, and a lot of woo, quantum woo, pseudoscience, and so on. But nevertheless, I think you can see clearly there is a rise in a spiritual movement. I myself don't agree with a lot of these spiritual movements, but it is a sign of the times that there is an inner awakening, so to speak, that expresses itself frequently, maybe more or less confused ways. And sometimes also at a criminal level, we have seen this, and there are sects and not particular examples come to my mind now, but I think this is a only the extremely negative side. But as a whole, I would say there is a rise in a spiritual movement, and the reaction from the materialist, from the physical side, must come, because it's the sort of the dragon that is feeling that it is dying, and so he has to fight against. Well, I interpret it in this way, so I take the optimist stance.
And I agree with you, Marco. I like the way you put it. Daniel, did you want to say something?
Well, actually, I'm just going to small observation. I think, Jaime, did you mention Peter Diamandis? Okay, so last Thursday, there was a conversation, like podcast conversation with him and Stephen Kotler. So Peter Diamandis, for those who you don't know, he's considered, like Fortune considered, one of the 50th greatest leaders, and he's a high-tech entrepreneur. And on that, it was a 2-hour conversation, but at one point they get into plant medicine, and Peter Diamandis specifically talks about his experience with 5-MeO-DMT, that he did 5-MeO-DMT in the form of BUFO, in the form of toad secretion. He talks about DMT, but he's referring it to be specific. It's about 5-MeO. And he says it was a revelatory experience. And he goes on to say that he is scientific, and he's like, thinks from himself a rationalist, but that experience for him like made him realize something. He doesn't want to call it God, but okay, so we are at this moment where people like him are having the opportunity to get this experience. And for me, idealism plays a big part in framing the theoretical framework for this. In terms of integration and that was my observation. And unfortunately, I have to go in 10 minutes. I will leave. So I'm going to say bye for.
Thank you. I didn't know about that. So it's good to know that he's eventually now going beyond his just physicalist and materialist, because he was a high-tech entrepreneur, as you said. Then there is this Ray Kurzweil also, that was the one that wrote the book about the singularities coming, which is this AI becoming more intelligent than the first human being, and then the whole human species on the planet, basically, and also eventually also becoming aware, right, and starting to think by herself, and so no, but good. I mean, and thank you, Marco, for your view there. I'm glad. I hope this is what what is really happening. I mean, the reason of my comment was because the heroes of a few centuries ago, or the big figures, were not really, I mean, except for the past 200 years history, yes, there were obviously the scientists, big scientists, Newton and Leibniz and all these guys, but before were basically the Pope, and this kind of more religious and philosopher, spiritualist people. And today the heroes are more the kind of these guys, okay, high-tech Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, plus Elon Musk, that wants to fly our species to Mars because it's the only way to really escape the miss of the human species, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what I see. But at the same time, I recognize, Marco, what you say, and perhaps it's just a reaction and over reaction also, and publicity, obviously, because those guys have a lot of resources, okay, to spend also on publicity, on how big and how great is science. So I'm fully sympathize also with that view. And I hope this is what is really happening. Thank you.
Can I make a request, Daniel, if you'd be so kind as to share that link with that conversation on the forum, because I would like to watch this.
For sure, yes, I will.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. I was going to ask for that as well. I wanted to go back to what Marco had said earlier. As a student of Gapser myself, he he kind of outlined these mutations of consciousness that have taken place in humanity over the course of their existence. And every time we go from one structure to another, there is this period of utter confusion and holding fast to what we know, because we don't want to let it go. And one of the reasons that religion and belief come into this is at the very base of everything. I noticed this in reading this part of Kastrup's book again. You get to a point when you start digging into this that at some point along the way, you simply have to say, well, this is what I believe. You can't know it. You don't know what it, you just believe it. And once you believe it, it's very, very hard to let go of that belief, because it was that belief that gave you the stability that you were looking for in that confusion. So when we start discussing with other individuals about how the world is or what is reality or what exists or what it doesn't, this is really getting down into the core of what we are as human beings. And my experience has been that, first of all, a lot of people don't even want to think about it. They don't want to deal with it at all. And then you have these academics, the specialists, the philosophers. The Germans have a very derogative term, the Fachidioten, the subject matter idiots, who will argue how many angels can dance on the head of a pin kind of thing. And then you have people like us who are neither these nor that, but normal people who are also just trying to figure out, well, how is it that we make our way through life? And we realize very quickly, it's really hard to talk about these things for a whole lot of reasons. So I always expect when we get together for a little session like this, that they're going to be messy. You know, it's never going to be clean. We're not going to be able to go, oh, well, this is the idealist. And, you know, because there's a Baskin and Robbins of 31 flavors of idealism. And then over here, there's the physicalist, and, you know, there's 31 flavors of physicalism. And it's really easy to lose yourself in this mass of detail, where in the end, what we're actually looking for is, how do I make sense of the life that I live, and how do I move through the world and apply that in some way that makes a difference? Because what I use these cafes for is for reinforcing, changing, modifying, revising my own thinking, so that when I'm interacting with my neighbors and we talk about things that matter after the 10th beer. This is, I know a lot of this went on in Dusseldorf last night, I'm sure. You know, what's the meaning of life kind of thing. And you realize that what those people in the pub are talking about, what the meaning of life is, has very little to do with what Ray Kurzweil or any of these other people have to, you know, or Elon Musk think the meaning of life is, because it's really hard to bring all of those together. And we can only do this on a case-by-case basis. I'm always fascinated by these folks who are about to achieve the singularity, and how we're going to genetically manipulate whatever it is. The human genome that has been mapped only accounts for 5% of our DNA. And the rest of it, the other 95% was designated as junk. So whatever it is we're manipulating, we're ignoring a whole lot of other stuff that just might be, we don't know yet. You know, this is, I come back to Jump's counters in the, it was driving me insane when I was watching the interview that Marco had posted, because he goes, yeah, well, if we just knew a little more, and if we could just add a little more, well, of course you can always add a little more. And I hope that they keep looking for the little more. And I encourage them to do so. And it may or may not get us to where we want to go, but I think it's worth the look. My problem with all of that is when you get locked in to what you think is the right way. You know, the statement that was made in the clip that John posted with McDermott and Seagull was Steiner and Betty's intent are to avoid both exclusivism and relativism. You know, it's not just this, and it's not just anything. There's something else. We've got to find some kind of middle ground, and we're probably all going to be dancing around that center or whatever it is, looking for it. And so I find it's very helpful. You know, Bernardo, I think, did a good job at countering the dominant mode of thought and pointing out it has its limits, and we need to be aware of those limits. And I think that any time you do that in that kind of environment, because it is an academic environment in this book at any rate, because he has these published and it's all part of that community kind of thing, I think you tend to overstate your case, because that's the way they talk about it in those spheres. And we have the luxury here amongst us to understate as well and to relativize sometimes the overstatements, realizing, okay, well, you have to make the really, really hard case so nobody's going to listen to you to begin with. And he does that. So that was the part of this whole exercise that I thought was so interesting. But I do believe, you know, if Gapes are postulated, we're transitioning to another structure of consciousness.
That's right.
If that were in fact the case, let's just act as if it is for a moment, then we would expect that there would be a lot of confusion and holding on to things that probably are questionable, because it's the last ditch effort to save the empire, so to speak. You know, I think we see this in American politics these days. It's also becoming apparent that there's just a whole lot more going on than what you would believe if you saw what's going on in the press. You know?
Yeah,
John.
Go ahead, John. I just wanted to respond briefly. Something Daniel mentioned about frameworks, and you're mentioning the drug experience of this entrepreneur, and it sort of broke through his sort of rigid materialism, and he's not necessarily given up materialism, but he's added something to his frameworks. And I think that's very important, that we note these kinds of the edges and the boundary conditions, and what's inside and what's outside, and does it have a size or shape? And our perceptual systems are driven around an edge. Our visual systems especially, but our entire perceptual systems, we have to create conditions for our ongoing embodiment. And there has been, I just read a book on what it called spinal catastrophism, that actually he thinks our bipedalism, that we stand up, has been a disaster. And that's why humanity suffers so much from backaches. And he was also saying, this writer was, who's a physiologist, I think, but he was saying that the spine is actually time. Crown is the future. The bottom of the pelvis is the past. And that different areas of our spinal column register a different kind of history. So the idea here is that the spine is a relic of our experience as fish, amphibians, reptiles, and now we bipedal creatures, we can stand, walk, run, dance. This is curious to me, as we find some kind of framework which can make sense and then create meaning, so that we can create meaning together. I'm reminded also of a quote from the Gospel of St. Thomas, a gospel that was persecuted and heretical, and it was buried in a jar in the desert somewhere, in a cave in Egypt. And we rediscovered it about 40 years ago and have translated it. But I love the beginning of it. It says, Jesus says to his disciple, Thomas, if you bring forth that which is within you, it will save you. If you do not bring forth that which is within you, it will destroy you. So I just wanted to add that to the mix, because I think we're in that sort of, oh, there's something within me that I want to give expression to, but it has to be in a social space that can receive it adequately, or it's going to blow my fuses. I'm going to be damned if I do, and I'm also going to be damned if I don't. So these are, I think, the tensions and stresses that a lot of us are feeling as we move between these liminal zones, between these different isms, and scratch our heads and say, what the hell is going on here? So I'm glad we found some companionship here and that we're moving together in these uncharted territories. Thanks.
I just want to connect to one thing that Ed said is, you know, the people, you know, don't want to think. And that's actually, it's interesting that because for the last 20 years, I've had to embrace, why don't I want to think about something? Due to certain life situations, I'll just put it that way, that forced me not to think about them because they were too painful. And I will draw on gaps here. I think intensity is very important to whether you think about something or not, because, you know, that intensity can cause you to shut down. But for my personal quest with why don't I want to think about this and working with that intensity, the only way I know how to language this is that thinking is not just mental. It's a play on words, but when I realized that thinking isn't just mental, that there's those liminal zones, which, John, I want to say that also are open zones. They're openings as much as betweenness, you know? And as I moved from that question into trying to heal from very traumatic experiences and use some physical, you know, physical medical strategies to help me heal, that actually, yeah, they serve a purpose, like swimming in a pool, like chiropractor, and, you know, some of those very things. But I, each time I was doing those things, to kind of, I want to give a shout out to Marco, there was a spiritual component to embrace those. There was something spiritual that was taking me to enact those, because otherwise I would just, you know, walk through it and not, the minute I added that component of whatever you want to call it, guys, things began to change. And I think I go along with what Ed said about gaps here, because I think we're in a mutation and it's messy. And to speak metaphorically, seeing my child being born is very much like what we're going through. Thank you.
Sounds like vulnerability. Is that the word?
That is the word, Kyle. Thank you.
I might also connect to something that Ed said, even if only briefly. You spoke about the Human Genome Project. I can remember well what kind of mediatic upheaval there was, and there was even President Bill Clinton who went on TV to announce the bright future that will come after the mapping of your human genome and so on and so on. And nowadays we know, well, yeah, there were interesting discoveries from the theoretical point of view, but when it comes to the practical application that they hoped for and that this human genome mapping promised for, and it did not at all meet the expectations. We mentioned genetic diseases. This treatment of genetic diseases is still, I'm not so sure that if all, but almost all these genetic diseases are still there and you cannot cure them. And we discovered that mapping a territory doesn't mean that you understand what this territory means. Huh? Yeah. But this is a lesson. This is extremely hard to learn. It's something that is deeply engraved in our minds, in our culture, in this reductionist, materialistic understanding of things. And I can see this also through my personal experience, because among other things, I never said this here, but I'm not a healer. I don't heal people. I don't have these prana, psychic energies, or, but I consider myself a self-healer. And I, by the way, I sometimes teach people how to see, self-heal themselves. And one of the, just to make an example, you don't have to be fearful. The more fear there is behind to get an illness, a sickness, and the more probable it is that you get it. And there are a list of inner, spiritual, but psychological attitudes to take that can help you in to remain in a very healthy situation. And all these people with whom there are a lot of people who come to me and want to know and say, yes. But when it comes to the practical application, I noticed interesting reaction that they don't believe it until they find in the literature the biochemical neurogenetic correlation, why this happens. So they need almost in an obsessive way to know always the neuronal genetic biomolecular mechanism that stands behind this self-healing. Only then they believe it. And I tell them, I'm sorry, there might be also some mechanism like that. I don't know nothing about that. I know only through my direct experience, try it, do it. That's also an empiric way, a scientific way to approach it. Do it and you will see that it works, even without knowing how it works. And there you see people have a tremendous difficulty to make the step. Because it's not about a blind faith. It is about a try, do it yourself, make the experience by yourself as first person, with a first person approach, and then you see that it works. No, they still need the third person perspective that first tells them how this works and then they believe it. And that's the big hurdle that we have with materialism, also among spiritual people, I think. There is this inner understanding that we should go beyond, but something keeps me back, and there are mechanisms of fear or doubt that continue to prevail. But I'm optimistic that also this will pass with time.
I think you're right, Marco, that it's going to pass. But that's the point that I think I was making as well about the belief. Their real belief is in what that expert says. That's where that comes from. It has to be shown to me biochemically, let us say, for lack of a better word, of how that is. Because even though they say, I believe, a lot of people go to church and do that too. You know, they say the creeds, they say all the prayers, you say all the litany, but you don't really believe it in that sense, like a believer would believe it. And what I think is lacking amongst a lot of people, and I understand why it's lacking, It's a very hard and arduous journey to look inside yourself. What's within you, it will destroy you or it will free you. But you have to look in there and find out, what do I truly believe? And simply acknowledge, you don't have to do anything with it other than acknowledge it. And know that when I'm dealing with things, that's where I'm coming from. And when other things conflict with that, I can think about how to deal with them as well. Now, I did notice, I don't want to break the flow or anything, but we're coming up on the top of the hour when we normally sign off. So if anybody has anything they'd like to throw in here at the end, now I think is the time to do it. So I'll get out of
there. Yeah, you make a good point, Ed, because in my experience working with what Marco and you are saying, one of the things I noticed, and it comes from my practice from meditation and Zen is so fucking hard ass on direct experience. What is that? Well, one of the things by that practice is, how do I experience my own belief? What is the experiential feeling of that belief, not just the abstract, distance, separate part of that schema? And the more I brought the belief directly into my experience and seeing how this isn't fucking working, believing that story that I can't heal or I can't do this, or so there is this step, I feel you two are pointing to from my direct experience, is the effective side of the way we, for lack of a better expression, conceive of what is real to us, for lack of a better expression. I'm trying to be very precise with my words, Marco.
Thank you so much. I just want to say briefly, in response to Ed, when I ask a question and I get the response that I expected, I take that as a sign that I've asked the wrong question, or I've asked a really bad question. So part of my enthusiasm about joining these conversations is to ask questions and meta questions, questions about our questions. And I just found myself wanting to respond to something that Ed has said about belief. And I think you made a very strong statement about belief. And I agree with you. And yes, and also, do we have to believe in our beliefs? Because I have beliefs. Some of them suck, and I would love to get rid of them, but I still believe them. There are beliefs that I would like to have that I don't have, but I'm open to maybe someday that will become a belief. But I don't necessarily believe all my beliefs. I have them. Some of them limit me. I'm sure lots of them support me. And I think this is a very deep dilemma that all it's really weaved into the human condition. So I think we're in this particular time of upheaval where so many belief systems and so many traditional ways of doing business are being shattered. So I feel that this cognitive dissonance that most of us, I think, have described on this call, I think that's great that we have a space where we can put that on the table and then sort of trust that there will be some kind of creative reorganization can start to happen. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, John. I liked how you said that.
Since I have not been on this in this group before, I just wanted to say thanks for everybody. This participation is really something I enjoy. So I look forward to more.
Thank you, Kyle. Come back, please.
Yeah, for sure. And it's We don't have to follow the lesson plan exactly, but I think we got some sense of mutual understanding, which, I mean, what else can you really get other than we're not going to come out of this with all these definitions of, you know, nailing everything down. But having a sense of mutual understanding, that's a pretty big deal. So this is good. Yeah, yeah. So do you guys always get off about this time?
Yes.
About a 2-hour meeting? Yeah, yeah. That's about my endurance.
The curtain is coming down.
The curtain is coming down. So we're going to have another one of these in a couple of weeks.
Yes, we are. I think we are. 2 weeks. Is there any other final comments, Marco?
I just... Yeah, just a quick one, just on what Marco said about the genome and the mapping and the conflation between the empirical observation and data collection, and then the explanation, right? And that it's really what reality is about. I think I think this summarized very well what Castro spoke about in these chapters, right? And this is the problem of the materialist view. It's precisely about this conflation, and I fully agree with that. And I hope we all become more aware, and I think we are becoming more aware of that. And I it's a very good thing. The other thing, picking up on Michael's thinking process and why people don't want to think, or we don't want to think about certain things, and that thinking is more than just thinking as a kind of a self-reflection, but actually it's difficult to express this in language, because language is also an abstraction of our it's one of those levels of abstraction. But I fully agree with you, and I think that's the problem. I think the educational system today doesn't encourage children and more adults really to think. And thinking sometimes is painful.
Yes.
But we want to avoid pain at all costs, because also we got, and I think this is also fruit of this materialist view, that pain is something that has to be avoided at all costs, right? Because it's bad, and we should avoid all pain. And I think that it's really hurting ourselves, because thinking is what can, I mean, again, sorry for quoting again Carl Jung, but I'm, as I'm reading more and more about Carl Jung, I really love more and more his psychology, but also worldview, and the way that, in summary, he poses that most problems of our society, etc., come from the fact that we don't want to face our, unconscious thing, where is that we throw all the thoughts that basically we don't want to be aware of. Okay. And this is causing really a lot of pain, and the only way to really solve that is really try to bring all those thoughts to the conscious level, to the aware. Because once it's there, you can start discussing, socializing, etc., and then you get healed, okay, by this. So this is very what I could get so far, okay, from what I, and I really like a lot that, but clearly, in many instances, healing instances, is going to be painful. And I think because of that, there is no education and encouragement really for people really to think, no, we should just watch Netflix. You know what? I mean, and that's it. We shouldn't worry about anything else. And yeah, so.
Well, in my response, and I like what you said, basically, and this is a nutshell, but it's really learning that pain has an intelligence that we need to listen to. It's part of life, And there, and if we didn't, it, just take the example of a leprosy. Part of the reason people leprosy progresses, my understanding, is they don't feel the pain of the skin. They don't feel the pain coming from the disease, you know, and so their skin starts to fall off. So this numbing ourselves or not giving attention to pain and having this, and it's a natural response not to want to feel. I'm not trying to downplay that. But I feel from my experience of growing up, I was taught, I think like you're saying, to avoid the pain and not think about, well, what's that about? Actually now engage my mental faculties, how I can change that, how without drugging it necessarily, like you say. So I'm on board. That's just the nuance I wanted to add to it.
Okay. I'll close with the comment that there's always many, many comments that I had along the way that didn't make it through. Don't need to bring up any of those right now. But I appreciate all that's been said, and I look forward to the next discussion. Thanks, guys.
Yes,
thank you.
As far as that next discussion is concerned, I'm going to try and put up a page by the end of the week. Where I'd like to look at least that's the schedule in my head, to look at the next part of Kastrup's book, part two, where he lays out his idealistic ontology. We'll have it's not a curriculum, it's a suggestion. Something to help stimulate the old thought processes. It worked real well the last time. We had a real good discussion leading up to this one. And if the good Lord's willing and the creek don't rise, we can get together. We can get together in 2 weeks and have it this again. And that's kind of like the plan for the moment. So on that note, gentlemen, I'd like to say this was time well spent for me. You all have to draw your own conclusions, but I certainly look forward to seeing you all the next time.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you all.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks.
Have a great 2 weeks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay.